second thing I want to show you a 12-minute clip from a movie called Show Up that was made by Claude Monsmith, a French-Jewish cinematographer. It was released about 20-something years ago. The full film is 9.5 hours long. Nobody can sit through it anymore, but it has brilliant pieces, and one segment particularly deals with the Greek Jews of one particular community, which I wanted to share with you so you can actually see people who were themselves at Auschwitz, Birkenau, in the time that I'm going to be discussing in this evening. Then I want to talk about the documents that were concealed, hidden away. You know the model of the person who's on a desert island and they write a message on a little piece of paper, stick the message in a bottle, put a cork in the bottle, toss the bottle into the ocean and hope that somebody will find it. It takes years, but they hope somebody will find it. In a certain way, a number of these Jews who were forced to do horrendous things at Auschwitz-Birkenau, they put messages into bottles, so to speak, and buried them in the ash pits next to the crematoria gas chamber complexes at Birkenau. It took some of these documents 50 years to float to the surface, so to speak, and be discovered. Most of them we know were never discovered. I'll explain more about it in a few minutes. I want to talk about the authors of the documents, very specific individuals. Most of them were Yiddish-speaking Polish Jews. One of them was a Polish Jew who moved to Paris and wrote a certain document in ungrammatical French. And one or two of the documents are in Greek. The one in particular I'm going to be talking about is by Marcel Najari from Salonika. It's a very unusual document, extremely unusual, for a particular reason having to do with his personal biography. It's something which he's mentioned, for example, in the Museum on Daring to Resist, on Jewish Resistance, that's on display at the Museum of Jewish Heritage at the Battery in Manhattan. At the very end of the exhibit, they quote him, this Greek Jew, from his last will and testament. And what they don't mention is a certain secret, which I will not tell you now, I will tell you in a few minutes. I'll then go on, time permitting, to talk about some aspects of the Sonderkommando world. Now, what's Sonderkommando? Sonderkommando is a long German word. It means literally special unit. Sonder means special. Kommando, it's a unit assigned soldiers, workers, whatever, to a particular job. The Sonder is special. In the Nazi usage of language during the Hitler period, they used language and corrupted it. They took plain meanings and changed them around. So, for example, the term Sonderbehandlung in German literally means special treatment. Now, how many of you have been treated specially by your parents, by loved ones? To be treated special is good, right? Except that among the Germans, special treatment meant killing. In the case of the Sonderkommando, they were the people assigned at Auschwitz and other death camps, but Auschwitz in particular is what we're focusing on. They were assigned to, quote-unquote, process the Jews who were going to be killed, mostly by gassing. Their bodies had to be moved. Their bodies were placed in ovens, were burned up, ground up, and so on and so on. The Germans intentionally used only Jews to do this horrendous and awful work. These were not volunteers. They're people who were picked at random. Well, they looked a little healthier from the trains of people arriving, and they were assigned to this horrendous, awful work. The Sonderkommando at Treblinka, death camp where 800,000 or more Jews were killed, including most of the Jews of Warsaw, the largest Jewish community of Europe. The Sonderkommando at Sobibor, located in eastern Poland, where over 250,000 Jews were killed, together with the Sonderkommando at Auschwitz-Birkenau, rose up in rebellion. The Germans had, during the 12 years of the Nazi era, they had more than 10,000 different concentration camps, forced labor camps, prison camps, and so on. In this entire empire of oppression, of slavery. Tens of millions of people were put through it. Only Jews and Gypsies were designated for mass gassing and a total annihilation, but still, horrendous treatment. In the entire history of the Nazi chain of concentration camps, death camps, there were only 6 instances of rebellions. The 3 in the death camps that I mentioned, Sobibor, Treblinka in 1943, Auschwitz in October of 1944, and at 3 smaller all-Jewish labor camps. This is an amazing thing. Why did the Sonderkommando rise up and rebel in these places? Why only the Jews? Something strange here. I'll leave this open now. It's a question we'll come back to a little bit later. In the case of Auschwitz, the Sonderkommando, from the beginning, end of 1941, beginning of 42, until the end of 1944, when the gassing was stopped at Auschwitz, the Sonderkommando included more than 2,000 different individuals. The largest group, probably Polish Jews. There were also captured Soviet prisoners of war, Jewish prisoners of war, put to this work. There were Hungarians. There were French. There were German Jews, all kinds of people. Periodically, the Germans would sift the group. The Germans were very careful about administering things. If you go to Auschwitz and visit the place or look at a map, you'll see that it's broken up into 2 quadrants that are separated by electrified barbed wire with guard posts strategically placed so that if there's a rebellion in one place, it can be suppressed very quickly without affecting the rest of the network of the camps. Auschwitz itself was huge. The Auschwitz complex covered 18 square miles. That is the size of the island of Manhattan from the George Washington Bridge and Fort Triumph Park in the north, all the way down to the Battery. It is huge, scattered across the Polish countryside with various facilities. Anyhow, this is by way of introduction. I now want to show you an actual Sonderkommando member. Of the 2,000 plus men, only men, who were employed in handling the bodies, perhaps only 100 survived the Second World War, sea liberation. Of those, not quite 100, 26 were Greek Jews. The gentleman you're going to be hearing now is named Franz Müller. He is a Czech Jew. The Jews of Slovakia, the eastern part of Czechoslovakia, were deported to Auschwitz before almost anyone else in 1942. This man, Franz Müller, is amazing in that, unlike the Sonderkommando members who were periodically culled and sent to be killed every 6, 8, or 10 weeks, 12 weeks, to prevent them from being able to make a rebellion, for a variety of coincidences, or he was recognized as being useful, he was lucky, he wasn't killed. He was there at Auschwitz from 1942 through 1944 and survived the war. He testified at the Eichmann trial in 1961. He testified at other trials of captured Nazi war criminals. And he was interviewed at length in about 1978 by Claude Lysman. The interview is conducted in German with subtitles, so I hope you'll be able to see this. I want you to see this man and hear him speak. And he's talking about telling people what happened. Lansman asked him, did you try to warn anybody about what's happening? And you'll see and hear what he says about that. He'll speak for about 3 minutes, and then we're going to go for a trip to Greece. The clip is only about 12 minutes long, so once we see that, you'll understand why I wanted you to see it. I will get this film.
Thank you. Pi minus 1, 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 Pi die Erfahrungen, das war nicht nur einmal, aber es waren einige Male, wo man das gesagt hat, haben gezeigt, dass es zu nichts bringt, dass es mehr Chaos bringt, dass es mehr noch dem Leben verschwert. Hauptsächlich, das hat einen, vielleicht einen kleinen Nutzen. Wir haben so geglaubt, gehabt bei Juden, die aus Polen kamen, oder bei den aus Theresien statt Familienlager, die durch halbes Jahr genau gelebt haben. Ja? Vielleicht hier hätte es noch einen Zuhörer, einen Zweck, ja, denen Menschen das sagen. Aber stellen Sie sich mal vor, in anderen Fällen, wie das war, Juden aus Griechenland, Juden aus Ungarn, Juden aus Korfu, die auf dem Weg 10 bis 12 Tage waren, verhungert und einige Tage ohne Wasser, kein Durstig. Die sind schon gekommen wie verwildet. Auf denen ist man anders gegangen. Denen hat man nicht gesagt. Denen hat man gesagt, ihr zieht euch aus und gleich bekommt jeder einen vollen Schüssel Tee. Und diese Menschen waren also so verwildet durch den, also das ist so viele lange, also eine lange Zeit, auf den Weg waren, dass ihr alles, ihr ganzes Gedanke war nur sich den Dusch zu löschen. Abgestimmt. Und die Hinten, dieses Arriskantenfilms, das war ein vorprogrammiertes, würde ich sagen, ein vorprogrammierter Vernichtungsprozess, der einkalkuliert war, dass wenn die Menschen so geschwächt würden sein, wenn man sie nicht geben würde, was zu trinken, dann würden sie gehen in den Gaskammer. Aber praktisch, wenn man es nimmt, da waren diese Menschen schon fast aufgrund der Vernichtung schon vorher gemacht. Stellen Sie sich mal vor, die Kinder, die haben gebeten, die haben Mütter, die haben geschrien, Mutter, ich bitte Wasser, 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 Wasser. Und selbst die Menschen, die einige Tage nicht gegessen haben, ja, waren also fixiert nur auf diese, dass wir also denen Menschen was sagen, bitte gib auf, wenn sie.
The island of Corfu is up the northwest coast of Greece. At one time it was controlled by Venice. Corfu is a typical Mediterranean city, and we're approaching it. Corfu was famous for many years for the production of Esrogin, for Sucos. The saying is, the shade gets out of Twitter after it, as beautiful as Esrog from Corfu. The city of Corfu was founded in the 14th century.
Me dimi ayer, me rogando, por una
2,000 Jews were shipped out of Corfu in June of 1944. Fewer than 180 came back. Today, that's the entire community of Corfu. I'm sorry, that was the entire community of Corfu 25 years ago when the interviews were done. These are people who work with their hands. I like the images there. You'll notice the way at the beginning, the marketplace, which is reminiscent of Machane Yehuda the way it was many years ago, that all these people were seen, and for a moment, in the center of the image, the forearm with the tattooed numbers, only Jews, only prisoners who were officially admitted to Auschwitz were given those numbers, were tattooed. At all other Nazi German concentration camps, people were given numbers, but they were a strip of cloth with a number they had to remember and respond to. Only at Auschwitz were the numbers of prisoners so large that they decided to go the route of branding people the way cattle are branded. So this is included here. We get to see these people who work with their hands. That's important. In order to survive at Auschwitz and some other places, if you had certain skills, this might be very useful. So Marcel Najari, that I'll be talking about a little bit more in a few moments, he was a trained electrician. That was important. That was useful. There are other people as well with certain skills. So this is a community that has been not decimated. The word decimated is misused when applied to Corfu. Decimated in the Roman times was a punishment if they had a military unit in the Roman legion that behaved badly in battle or so on. Every tenth man was chosen and executed, crucified. That's decimation. And this is the other way around. 9 out of 10 wiped out. The community is essentially dead. Salonika, the largest of Greek Jewish communities, out of 70,000 or so Jews who were there at one point, 2,000 came back. Today, a very tiny community remains. Anyhow, I wanted you to see some of the people. We don't have a lot of detailed photographs from Auschwitz showing the Sonderkommando. In fact, it was absolutely, absolutely forbidden. Among the handouts that, what is your name, please?
Alicia
was kind enough. Not only was she the first person here, but she even agreed when I asked her to put around the handouts. There are three handouts.
I suppose.
Okay. Everybody gets credit. The sheet, which has three photographs on it, those are unique photos. They were taken by a member of the Sonderkommando with a secret miniature camera that was smuggled in by the underground among the prisoners at Auschwitz. They smuggled in a tiny camera with a single roll of film. He was able to take three pictures from inside the doorway of one of the main crematory gas chamber complexes. And you see that they're not centered exactly. They're off center at an angle well, but that's what you do. In the top two instances, they show the burning of bodies in long trenches outside the crematoria complexes. That was done because they simply found that while they could kill a lot of people, it took longer to get rid of the bodies than it did to kill the people. The picture on the bottom, very blurred, is of women for the most part who have been forced to remove all their clothing, and they are walking from the undressing areas to the gas chamber. And they will be dead within minutes of this picture having been taken. These are unusual. We don't have other photos to show you of that time. Now, it's not that there aren't any photos from Auschwitz. There are many photos that were taken by SS Nazi German soldiers, officials who were there, and they've been published in a book that was called in German, Schöne Zeit, in English called The Good Old Days. Because they lived very well at Auschwitz. And they got rich in many cases at Auschwitz from the goods that were stolen from the Jews who were brought to be killed. Sonderkommando was very much involved in this whole bizarre network of things. Now, there are two maps that you have as well.
One map is a political map of Central and Eastern Europe to give you an idea of where Auschwitz is relative to Greece. You can see where Salonika is, where Corfu is. You can get a sense of the distances involved. If you notice, Auschwitz-Birkenau is virtually in the center of the map. If you look at the other map that shows you the transportation vectors from which places people were shipped, Jews were shipped to Auschwitz-Birkenau, it's from all over Europe, western, eastern, southern, northern. Jews were brought as much as 1,500 miles and more to this one strange location. Why to Auschwitz? The Germans made a very conscious decision when they established Auschwitz. They located it in the nexus point, the central point of all rail transportation in Europe. Every rail line from west to east, north to south, comes through or very near Silesia, which was then southeastern Germany, is now southwestern Poland, and it was a practical decision when you're building a factory of death. They wanted it to be there. The longest distance that anybody was transported to get to Auschwitz to be killed was from the island of Rhodes. If you look at the lower right corner of the map, you see Rhodes is right off the coast of Turkey, an ancient Jewish community. Yeah.
It's an interesting question. Why did you kill them?
Why did he kill Jews?
Yeah.
On one foot. He didn't like them. He thought they were bad. And he thought they were bad the way people think cockroaches are bad, the way they think germs are bad, the way they think the HIV virus is despicable. And if there's a way of destroying it, it should be done. The Germans spoke of Jews as if they were vermin, rats, cockroaches, lice, bedbugs, Cyclone B, Z-Y-K-L-O-N, Cyclone B, that's the trade name for hydrogen cyanide, hydrocyanic acid. It's related to, it's cyanide. It was originally developed as a bug killer. It rid roaches, literally. And it was produced in a series of different concentrations. Cyclone B was designed for large mammals. Mammals are warm-blooded creatures. Humans are large mammals, so are cattle, so are monkeys. And they used this particular concentration for killing Jews. They also used to get rid of other mixes to get rid of lice.
Was rumored at that time that Germany was in depression, in recession, and in order to get out of the recession, that happened?
If you, I'm going to be giving a course at the end of August at Brooklyn College on history of the Holocaust. 14 weeks, we go into a lot of detail. On the thumbnail sketch, Germany lost World War I. The middle class was totally bankrupt. Everybody who had savings was wiped out three times over. There was hyperinflation, so even if you had cash, you were poor. Horrendous. There were revolutions, coups, and so on. There were governments changing all the time. And then things got worse. 1929, the stock market crashes here in New York. The United States starts demanding the repayment of all debts owed to it from France and England. France and England demand reparations payments due in the billions and billions and billions from Germany. The Germans don't pay. The Austrians can't pay. The Kreditanstalt, the bank founded by the Rothschilds originally way back when, collapses in 1930, and that's the Great Depression. 3 years later, Hitler is named by the President of Germany to be the Chancellor. He is named legally. He does not seize power in an armed revolution. He is appointed by the President of the Republic according to the rules of the Constitution of Germany, rules that were written in 1919 by Professor Dr. Hugo Preuss, a German Jew, who wanted a democratic constitution with teeth. Life is Strange. But that's not what I'm talking about tonight. So, just to go on. We know that many documents were concealed by the Sonderkommando members to try to communicate to the world what they saw, what was going on. We know that those three photographs were taken because they were smuggled out and eventually published only at the very end of the war after Auschwitz had been shut down and liberated. We know that in August of 1944, members of the Sonderkommando at Auschwitz decided that they had no chance of surviving, that the Germans were going to kill them one way or the other, so they might as well rebel. The general camp underground at Auschwitz that was led largely by Polish left-wing political prisoners supported the idea of rebellion, but urged timing is everything. When the Russian Red Army is right on the outskirts and there's a rebellion, the Germans won't have time to kill everybody. But if there's a preemptive rebellion, premature, the Germans are fully capable of killing all 200,000 prisoners at Auschwitz. So, as the Red Army is advancing, 44, the general camp underground is interested in delaying any rebellion as long as possible. The Jews and the Sonderkommando, however, know that the longer they delay, the bigger the possibility that the Germans will get around to killing them, because there is no way that the Germans will allow any witnesses of this massive, horrendous action to survive. A couple of statistics just to nail some things down. How did the Germans kill umpteen millions of Jews? The Germans established over 400 ghettos in Poland, Lithuania, Latvia, Belarus, Ukraine, primarily. 600,000 Jews died so-called natural deaths in those ghettos of starvation, of disease aggravated by starvation. Hundreds of people were shot in many ghettos and so on, trying to escape, trying to smuggle all these things. 600,000 people. That's the same number as were involved in the Yitzhak Mitzrayim, the exodus from Egypt. 600,000 people. That's more Jews than live in Brooklyn today. If there were 600,000 Jews in any city of the United States, that would make it the second largest city Jewish community in the United States. 600,000 in one of natural causes, but it wasn't fast enough for the Germans. So they had something called Einsatzgruppen, which were mobile killing squads. But the term, as I said before, if they use language in a familiar way, Einsatzgruppen simply means special duty task forces. It's a very, very loose term. 3,000 German men, many of them with university education, including doctorates, and people who were ordained ministers, 3,000 men, they were involved in going from town to town, primarily in Eastern Europe, after June 1941 when they invaded the Soviet Union, and killing as many as they could by the old-fashioned way of shooting for the most part. They killed at a minimum 1,500,000 Jews. Probably more. We're finding more information from the archives after the fall of the Soviet Union. Maybe as much as 2 million plus. But there's a problem with killing so many Jews. How do you kill somebody if you've got a gun? Point the gun, shoot. There's a problem. Christopher Browning, who is an amazing scholar, an important scholar, wrote a wonderful short book called Ordinary Men. He looks at a particular group of German policemen from Hamburg, Germany, who were turned into killers in one of these Einsatz groups. And he describes how they became killers. And he said that it was not easy. These were men in their 30s, married with children, and they're ordered that they have to start shooting men, women, children, the old, the sick. If you fire a bullet at a person, it is not clean. Television and movies in the United States, unless the mother, Tarantino brothers, they tend to be very, very antiseptic. Bullet hits somebody, they fall. There's a little blood. were upset because their clean uniforms were covered with brains and other tissue. They would back up as much as 10 meters. But if you fire with a high-powered rifle at somebody, the splatter goes 10 meters, like from that end of the room to this end of the room. It was distressing. They experimented with different ways of killing. In Minsk, in Belarus, Heinrich Himmler, head of the SS, visited, and for his benefit, they staged a public demonstration of a new technique for killing. They put 1,000 Jews into the main marketplace and detonated a mine, a landmine, and a bomb in the middle of the crowd. Heinrich Himmler, head of the SS, is involved in thwarting the murder of millions. Vomited up everything he ate since he was a little kid. Not good. Distressing. Not that they were killing was distressing, but it wasn't aesthetic. They experimented with gassing people in mobile trucks where the exhaust pipe was put back into the cargo area. People get carbon monoxide poisoning. That worked, but not as well as other things, factories. And so they came up with a new method, the death camp. I mentioned there were thousands of Nazi German concentration camps and prison camps. There were 6 death camps. Only 6. Auschwitz was the biggest one. Not the first one, but the biggest. Auschwitz was the place where 1.1 million Jews were probably killed. Minimum number. It may have been half again as high as that. Treblinka, over 800,000. Belzec, near east of Lublin, over 600,000. Sobibor, 250,000. Majdanek, around 200,000. And Chelmno, the first operational death camp. It went into operation on Sunday, December 7th, 1941. You think that day's going to live in infamy? Less than 3,000 Americans were killed at the attack on Pearl Harbor. Chelmno was where 370,000 Jews, half of them from Poland and many more from other countries of Europe, from as far west as France, were brought and were gassed and buried in massive pits. Anyway, how many people got killed in all those camps? Do you add up the numbers? 3.1 million. That's a minimum estimate. The Germans were interested in destroying Jews. Now, why did they go after the Jews, killing the Jews? Some people argue it was because they were losing the Second World War, and they decided to go down killing all the Jews. But the decision to start killing large numbers of Jews is made before they lose the war. It's before Stalingrad. They were doing it because they believed it was the best thing to do for humanity, for German humanity, and so on. Just like Ahmadinejad, the president of Iran, does not believe the 6 million Jews were killed during the Second World War, but he is in favor of killing the 6 million Jews who live in Israel today, which is not totally logical, but it is consistent with a particular outlook. Anyhow, in the summer of 1944, the Sonderkommando decided they wanted to rebel, but they also wanted to leave something. So each member of the Sonderkommando was urged to write on whatever paper they could get, with whatever pencil or pen, their last words, and they were buried. Those documents were wrapped up carefully, put in a bottle, into a mess kit, into a bag, buried in the ash pits adjacent to the crematorium. We know that dozens and dozens were buried, but only 6 or 7 documents were discovered since the end of the Second World War, between 1947 and 1980. It's like the Dead Sea Scrolls, so to speak, except the big problem. Why is the Dead Sea Scrolls still legible 2,000 plus years since they were written? Yeah. The climate in the Judean desert around the Dead Sea is wonderful for preserving documents. Poland, however, is a green land. That's the title of a recent book by Aaron Appelfeld, Poland, Arez Yurkop. It's a very, it's very green, but that greenness is because it rains a lot, the soil is moist, and unfortunately the documents suffered. All of these documents are, in effect, crippled survivors, historical survivors of what was. I'm involved in a project now to prepare a new translation in English of many of these documents between, in conjunction with the Museum at Auschwitz and the University Press. One of the difficulties is that much of the material is virtually illegible. I have urged the Museum at Auschwitz actually to apply the techniques of Dead Sea Scrolls research, where they use infrared technology to bring back writing which is otherwise illegible, invisible. So far they haven't agreed, but I think they should do it. Who are the writers of these documents? As I said, most of them were writing in Yiddish because they were Polish Jews. One was a Jew from Poland who lived in France, so he wrote in French. And there are one or two documents in Greek. These authors were all men. It's not that women don't know how to write, but the cultural bias in European culture has been, for a long time, women don't produce cultural things of value, at least not of written material. Supposedly, Esther Kreitman, the sister of Isaac Bashevis Singer, the Nobel Prize-winning author, who had two brothers who were great writers, I.J. Singer and Isaac Bashevis Singer, supposedly she also wanted to be an author. And supposedly, she heard her father say to his sons, you will grow up to be great men, great intellectuals, great teachers, the Jewish people. And so Esther Kreitman supposedly said to her father, what will I be when I grow up? And he supposedly responds to you, nothing. You're a girl. It's a certain attitude. Anyway, that's for another lecture, another talk. Each of these authors is in his 20s, middle 20s to mid-30s. They are vigorous, they are strong, and they know that they will not survive. They are totally convinced that whatever happens, whatever rebellion might have, they will not survive. This will be the last communication that we'll have, possibly to whoever reads it eventually. The documents I mentioned are in awful condition. They are hard to read, but they tell us some amazing things. We know the names of these several authors. Number one is a man named Zalman Leventhal, 27 years old. 1944, he was a yeshiva student in Chekhanov, Poland. He writes in his diary, and a piece of advice for the future historian, look in the ashes. See, weiter in the ashes, look further in the ashes, you'll find a lot more. It's very important. What he did was partly his own writing and a 350-page diary from the large ghetto, the second largest ghetto in Poland, this long-surviving ghetto. 350 pages, I'm excited about that because I write about Lodz. Unfortunately, three-quarters of it is illegible, but he writes an analysis of it and says this guy is absolutely wrong about who's to blame for these different things going on. Leventhal argues that most Jews went like sheep to the slaughter. That was typical. That's the way most people are when confronted with violence. Zalman Gradovsky, another man, another Jew, religious, from northeastern Poland, from a town called Suwałki, near the Lithuanian-Belarusian borders. Married, he had a daughter. His wife and daughter were killed as soon as they arrived in 1943. He was chosen to be in the Sonderkommando. He writes some amazing things. Eyewitness testimony that after a day of being involved in killing Jews, burning their bodies, grinding their bones, he would, in his off hours, go up to the Canada section, that's the warehouse area where they, all the property stolen from the Jews came, and he would go through looking for certain things. He would look for a talis, polyphyllin, and he would put on polyphyllin and recite Kaddish for the Jews he had killed. We know from his own testimony, his writing, that he decided one day that he wanted to have a Kabbalat Shabbat at Birkenau in the Sonderkommando barracks. He got a few guys together. I'm not sure if he had a full minion or not, but they got together. They sang. And so a number of the other Sonderkommando members complained and made fun. How can you do this? It's silly. It's crazy. But a strange thing happened. Week by week, they continued. More and more people showed up. Bizarre. Very strange. Gradovsky writes about hoping for rebellion. there was a group of Czech Jews who were allowed to live in a family group 6 months at Birkenau. It was hoped that because they were in good physical condition and they were alert, they might make a rebellion. They didn't. Radovsky writes about the Czech family camp that unfortunately they went like everybody else and they were killed just like the Americans. I was absolutely astounded. I read a lot and I read it again. Just like the Americans. What Americans were at Auschwitz? It is known that the Einsatz commandos had killed Jews by shooting in many towns in Lithuania, Belarus, and so on. They kept lists of the passports and documents they got from people, and they listed how many Lithuanian Jews, Polish Jews, they killed. And on the documents, the document, individual United States passport-carrying Jews who had the misfortune of being in those places, but a whole group of Jews, American Jews, at Auschwitz. Apparently, it's not United States American Jews. America is bigger than the United States. It includes South America. There were 1,500 Jews who had papers claiming that they were citizens of Ecuador, Paraguay, El Salvador, and so on, which kept them alive for a time. Many of them were in Vitel and France, and then they were brought, almost all of them, to Auschwitz and were killed. A third person I want to mention is Harav Leib Lankfus. Lankfus in Yiddish means long foot or long leg. Rabbi Leib Lankfus was from the town of Machow Mazowiecki in central Poland. He was the assistant rabbi, but because his father-in-law, the chief rabbi, was old and a little ill, he took over. The whole community of Ms. Mazowiecki was sent to Auschwitz, and virtually all were killed. The average stay for any Jew sent to Auschwitz was no more than 4 hours. 95% of the Jews who were sent to Auschwitz-Birkenau were killed within 4 hours or less of their arrival. So when we hear survivor accounts of what they went through and so on, there's a problem. It's good that they survived. My parents were surviving. My father was in Auschwitz. But that they survived is not normative. The normal experience for Jews sent out to their towns to be killed almost immediately. To survive, bizarre. Rabbi Leib Lankfus was chosen, a rabbi in his 30s, chosen to be in the Sonderkommando. When he realized what it was, he was upset. The other members of the Sonderkommando recognized that he was a special person. And they, among themselves, fixed it that he would not handle any of the bodies. Instead, they gave him a broom and he would sweep. Or they had him stand at a door to watch people traveling back and forth. He watched, he listened, and he wrote. One of the documents that he had, again, I have to be very careful about talking about it because I'm affected every time I read the materials. In the summer of 1944, 500,000 Hungarian Jews were shipped to Birkenau and were killed. As they arrived, they were taken to the crematoria places where there was a large room, larger than this, and they were ordered to take their clothing off. He describes how, in one case, there were two Hungarian Hasidim, who were there, and they see this Sonderkommando fellow, and they ask him in Yiddish, should we recite the confession before death? He says, are we going to be killed? And the answer is, at which point, one of them pulls out a bottle of schnapps that he smuggled into the undressing room, and they start making a l'chaim, and they drink very happily, and they offer it to the Sonderkommando. Macha brocha, make a blessing, have a drink. Lankfus writes in third person, he was broken. He was astounded. And they insisted. And they insisted. And insisted that he had to make a bracha, had to drink the whiskey, because he had to survive to tell the story. They would not. He tells another story about the Boyana Rebbe. The Boyana Rebbe was the successor of Rabbi Meir Shapiro, the founder of Yeshiva Chafei Lublin, the greatest yeshiva in Poland.
The Guyana Rebbe spoke many languages, including German, very well. He describes the Guyana Rebbe in the undressing room. Like everybody else, he was told to take his clothing off. He was naked. A German walking by, the Guyana grabs the German by the lapels and starts shaking him. Azoidi Alulav, and he writes, like shaking a lulav, and tells him in the fanciest German that you lousy, no good, national killing heart. But Marangirat Taknarain told him curses going back to his father's father's father. You won't get away with it. Throws the German aside, grabs his hat, sticks it on his head, closes his eyes, and yells out Shema Yisrael, and everybody in the room does as well. And everybody who witnessed it was killed in a few minutes, except for Rabbi Leib Langfuss, who writes about the failed Jewish uprising of October 1944, that he was supposed to be the one to take the small bomb that they had into, literally, into the Kishan HaEsh, into the fiery furnace to blow up the furnaces. There are many stories in there. There's one, for example, of an old woman who was from Hungary who, in February of 1944, had heard the Belzer Rebbe speak to them. The Belzer Rebbe was one of the great Hasidic Rebbes who managed to escape from Europe with the help of many people. He managed to get to the land of Israel before the end of the war. He passed through Hungary, and he told Jews there, Hungary was quiet, it was February 44, it was not yet dangerous, stay here, God will help, and he left. One old Rebbe, a widow of a certain Hungarian rabbi, cursed him for having abandoned the Jews, for having lied to the Jews. We have all kinds of strange things included in these documents. They are amazing things. In the case of the Boyaner, seeing the Lanka seeing the Boyaner Rebbe and his demonstrative act, he describes how he went back up to the burning room and sat down on the floor and cried for hours, moaning and groaning, he writes, of burning of Jews. Why did these people all commit suicide? You know, of course, there's a whole lot of problem with suicide. Because if you have suicide is a death penalty offense. That was a joke. But it's a serious thing. It's not your life to give away. Additional person named Herman writes, is a French Jew. I won't go into him in detail. I want to talk about Marcel Najari. I keep mentioning Salonika. I want to get to Salonika. Marcel Najari was born in 1917. He was in his 20s, not married. He had fought for the defense of Greece against the Italian invaders in 1940. He was captured by the Italians and captured by the Germans, who put the concentration camp in Greece. Eventually ends up in Athens, and from Athens, in early 1944, he was shipped to Auschwitz-Birkenau, and he's chosen for the Sonderkommando. In August of 1944, he writes a 12-page little note in a group of pages that he had about what he found. We know a little bit about Najari from witnesses who survived. Daniel Benachmias, a survivor from the Sonderkommando, mentions that Najari was a remarkable mind, like Marcel. He would imitate the way people acted when they first arrived at Auschwitz, the way they acted when they got into the undressing room, the way they acted when they got into the gas chamber. It was very entertaining and moved people to tears. Benachmias writes that Najari was so good, even the Polish Jews didn't like the Greek Jews very much. They were moved to tears as well by this mimic, this mind. Najari writes two things. I want to share with you what he's written. This is going to be very short because most of the document is totally illegible. The water-based ink ran. But we have a few things. First, to my beloved fatherland, Greece, to which I was always a good citizen. He's loyal. He left Athens, he writes, on the 2nd of April, 1944. A whole page of illegible.
3,000 people locked into a room and gas. They expire after 6 to 7 minutes, describing what he saw. They put in gas. Then they brought the bodies of these innocent women to the ovens and burned. And they forced us to carry it, the ashes through the trench and load it onto vehicles and throw it into a river that flows swiftly, erasing everything. When they burned the bodies in the ovens at Auschwitz, the ovens were designed so that they could burn 3 bodies at a time. The Germans were efficient. But they found that if you burn 3 men at a time, it's not as good. You have to have at least 1 woman in the group. Women have more subcutaneous fat, more body fat than men do. The ovens were designed in such a way that the bodies burning themselves, the fat coming off the bodies themselves, would fuel the fire. Talk about being very thrifty. The Germans thought of everything. Now, what kept them alive? He writes, only constant feelings for revenge kept me going. I wanted and I want to survive, to avenge the death of my dad, my mom, and my beloved sister Nella. If I don't survive, find out, and then it's blank. I don't know what he wants to find out. My sole desire is that they should receive, and then it's blank. What do you want? In Birkenau, I don't regret that I will die only because I will not be able to take revenge as I want and can. And if you somehow get a letter from our relatives abroad, I ask you to write back immediately that the Najari family was killed by the civilized Germans. My Nella's piano should be taken by Mitzov, who's a cousin, I think, from the Sionid family and given away to Elias, so that he should always have it and remember Nella, whom he loved and who loved him. There's a whole story there which we don't have enough background to say with something going on. Nearly daily we consider whether God still exists. This is written by his undercommando at Birkenau on a document he hides in the Auschwitz. Nearly daily we consider whether God still exists, and despite that I believe that God exists. Whatever God wishes, let his will be done. I die content because at this moment our Greece is liberated. I will not survive. May others survive. Long live Greece. Now there's a postscript. It's addressed to the Honorable Embassy of Greece. Presumably they find a Greek letter will turn over to the Greek embassy. From one Greek named Emmanuel or Marcel Najari of Salonika. The address is 9 Amalia Street, Salonika. Please forward my letter to best friend, Dimitrios Athanasion Stefanidis. And that's the end. This is my final wish. I have been sentenced to death by the Germans because I am of the Hebrew religion. I told you at the beginning that his piece was quoted in the exhibit at the Museum of Jewish Heritage. They don't tell you. What I want to tell you is he didn't die. He survived. He was one of 11 Greek Sonderkommando members who did not die, survived the war. In 1947, he wrote a memoir in Greek that he stuck away in a drawer someplace. He got married, had a son. He and his wife moved from Salonika to New York. I think it's Brooklyn. I'm not sure where. He died in 1971. His document that was buried in the ashes at Auschwitz-Birkenau was only discovered in 1980. In 1991, his memoir was published in Greek by the Salonika Jewish community. Strange story. He survived. Moses Onikomando did not. One last thing. I apologize for talking at length, but I'm obviously interested in this. If I have an audience, I'll take advantage of it. One last thing about the Jews of Corfu that I showed. Why do I show the Jews of Corfu? I mentioned that in June 1944, the entire community of 2,000 is shipped out. Only about 180 come back alive.
450 of those young men, Jewish young men from Corfu, were offered the opportunity to kill Hungarian Jews as members of the Sonderkommando. And those 450 young Jewish men said, no. They told the Germans, no. We would rather die than kill the Hungarian Jews. And the Germans obliged to kill them. This is an amazing case of hoc valiavor, as they say. You're allowed to bring a ham and cheese sandwich, whatever you want you can do, except for three items, according to the Torah. You cannot commit adultery or incest. You cannot commit idol worship. You cannot kill an innocent person, even if it's at the cost of your own life. 450 young men from an entire... It's amazing. I mean, what kind of portion of the community would have this? It's not that they were suicidal, but they knew what they could not allow themselves to do or be used to do. What is happening? Now, I had intended to stop earlier and be able to take some questions. I know that people are very polite, or they're afraid of me, one or the other, and are not just going to get up and leave. If you need to leave, if you want to leave, you may leave. I will not be offended. But if you have some questions or comments you'd like to make, I'd like to hear them and take them if it's okay. Yeah.
There are many answers. Why do the world stay silent? Why do the world stay silent? They're talking about killing each other, killing Jews. How can you know what it is?
It's not like it's real people. Put it another way. Why did the world remain silent when Jews are being killed? I say facetiously, Jews are not people. What have you done in order to stop the killing of the blacks in Darfur in southwestern Sudan?
I sent them $1.
And they will contribute almost as much as you're in trouble. That's the way people are. Charity starts at home. You do what you can locally in the world. Hopefully the Rabbanu Shalom will take care of it. But still, they're promised something else. The world is different. What's the difference? How is it that Hillary Clinton will say explicitly, if Iran drops a nuclear bomb on Israel, the United States, under her leadership, will destroy Iran? She says it. She says it. Now, whether it's real, whether you can believe it, she says it. What's going on? In 1942-43, out of the 435 members of the House of Representatives, there were, I believe, seven Jews. Seven Jews. Today, there are 38 Jewish members of the House of Representatives. It gets better. In 1942-43-44, I believe there was one Jewish senator. Today, there are 11 out of 100. I used to teach at the Ramaz School before coming to Brooklyn College, and one of the courses I taught was a senior elective called Jewish Power and Politics. And the students and I, we went to visit different people and asked them, is there such a thing as Jewish power? Who did we ask? We went to John Ruske, who's head of the New York Jewish Federation. He described how they opened the annual campaign with a parlor meeting in Manhattan on the Upper East Side, and among the guests who were attending, not expected to contribute, but the guest, was then-Governor Pataki, who was thinking of running for president or something. And he watched, according to Ruske, watched with his jaw open, as within 30 minutes they raised almost $40 million. According to Stephen Bay, who is one of the officials of the American Jewish Congress, American Jewish Committee, I should say, in the 2000 election, a majority of the money contributed to the Democratic National Committee's coffers, campaign coffers, came from Jews. Among the Republicans, only about one-third came from Jews. That means, in the year 2000, half of all the contributions came. What's going on? Jews, 65 years ago, were still newcomers to America. They still didn't know how everything works. They still have not graduated from college or opened up their businesses and multiplied. Today, you have Sheldon Adelson in Las Vegas.
if you need $100 million or $200 million or $500 million, if he's convinced it needs to be given, he can write the check. Jews give, and so they are fortunate. It's an interesting thing. Today is not what was 65 or 70 years ago. How much money does the United States provide to Israel in direct aid from the foreign aid budget? $3.1 billion a year. This has been going on since Jimmy Carter was there as part of the bribes to make peace with Egypt. How much does Egypt get as part of the deal? $2.1 billion. How much does Jordan get? Something like $600 million a year. That's a third of the regular foreign aid budget going either for Israel or Israel-connected countries. It's worth it. Every penny is worth it. How did they do that? Is it a conspiracy? Or is it the Jews have learned in the United States partly how to play the system? And also, maybe Jews are popular now, and 70 years ago they weren't. It's a very strange thing. The world is a little bit different. I don't think that what happened 70 years ago would happen today. Something else will happen. The world is different. That's a long answer, but what it is, Jews... Malcolm Henline, who is the executive director of the Council of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations. The name is big. When the president wants to talk to the Jews, they call him to arrange a meeting with the council. He was asked at Ramaz, is it true that Jews have real power in America? Is that his answer to anybody who asks is, you don't know the half of it. Privately says, alibi, it would be that good. But it's an interesting matter. The Chinese People's Republic has a major embassy here in New York for the UN and so on, and it was designated official to deal with the American Jewish community. When the president of the American Jewish Congress, the American Jewish Committee, goes to China, they meet with the president of China. They have a strange sense of where the power is. What's the reality? What's the...
Follow the money, always.
It's not just the money. It's the willingness to give. Town and Country Magazine, which I assume everybody here subscribes to. Town and Country Media. Town and Country Magazine focuses on wealth, power. They ran a series on philanthropy, and they found there is a distinct difference between how Episcopalians give charity and how Catholics give charity and how Jews give charity. Episcopalians and Catholics tend to give charity mostly through their wills after they die. Jews give charity while they are alive. Why? Want the covet. Why not? Why not? The Yitzhahara are serving in service of good things. Anybody else have a question or a comment they'd like to raise? I apologize. It's kind of, people get worn out after the first 3 hours.
Lost the war. What can one say?
cut is what I mean. You're not touching, but you're not touching.
The Jews of Greece were virtually wiped out. Only 10,000, but that's a major community. The Jews of Bosnia, Yugoslavia, of Sarajevo, Yaron Gaon, the famous singer, his family's from Sarajevo, his father's from Sarajevo. Virtually none of his father's family survived. There's a film in which he visits Sarajevo, and at the Holocaust Memorial that's there in the Jewish cemetery, he stands in front of a wall which has the names of all the Jews of Sarajevo by family and first name, and you see Gaon, 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 big family. The only one who survived was Yaron Gaon's father, who had made Aliyah and moved to Israel before the Second World War. Horrendous destruction. Now, Bulgaria, that's what you mean. Bulgaria is a country which, although it was allied with Nazi Germany and had 50,000 Ladino-speaking Sephardi Jews, they refused to deport their Bulgarian Jews to Germany to control to be killed. They refused. They mean they didn't like killing Jews. Bulgaria got control of the northern part of Romania called Dobruja, where there were, and part of Macedonia, where there were 11,000 Jews, and the Bulgarians voluntarily gave them up because they weren't Bulgarians. But they were kept. As for other Sephardic Jews, the Germans did not get a chance to get organized, but I'll tell you something scary. In the summer of 1942, Rommel's Afrika Corps, the German army in North Africa, came within 60 miles of Alexandria, the greatest port city of Egypt. If they had conquered Alexandria, the British military would have had to fall back, and the British recognized they could not hold Egypt or the Sinai. They wouldn't be able to hold Palestine. They wouldn't be able to hold Syria. They were going to fall all the way back to Iraq and try to set up new lines there. What would happen to the 500,000 Jews of the Yishuv? Well, the idea was they might be evacuated, but some people said, we will not move. Came here to get out of Galut, not to go to Galut. A plan was prepared to have a last battle. It's horrendous. Where would you fight the Germans? One proposal was to go to Har Carmel, on the top of Mount Carmel, at the place where Eliyahu HaNavi fought the 300 Nevi'ei prophets of Baal, and have the last battle there. It would have been suicide. But they were not going to move. I was told about this in part by the late Dr. C. Kolitz. Dr. C. Kolitz was from Kelme in Lithuania. His brother was the Rav HaRashi Ashkenazi of Yerushalayim for many years. Kolitz actually did not favor having a last battle at Carmel. He advocated going to the Dead Sea, where there are caves he knew at that time, and hiding in the caves. Didn't happen. Fortunately, a parenthetic remark, there were a group of German Jews who were recruited by the German, by the British military to stay behind after the British would evacuate Palestine and Egypt, and they would pass up themselves off as German soldiers, but they spoke German like Germans, they were German. They drilled in the Sinai and in the Negev in German uniforms and with German books. They were supposed to be spies and so on. They fortunately didn't have to do that in Egypt or in Palestine. They did do it at Tobruk. Famous, famous, famous Tobruk. They were part of that battle. Quite amazing. In any case, this is a vast story. What is remarkable is that the Holocaust happened over 60 plus years ago. Almost as a lifetime, practically, and it becomes, in certain ways, an ever greater and more influential movement. It has echoes, like the rock thrown into a still pond, and the waves go on and on, theoretically forever. Those waves become more powerful as people become more aware of individuals. One of the things that I've been trying to do is to work on diaries and personal documents, and that's what I'm trying to talk about this evening. Again, I'm giving people an opportunity to bail out. If you need to leave, if you want to leave, if you think you might want to leave. You are free to leave. I won't be hurt. If you want to stop and get a cookie on the way, that's okay too. Let me make the suggestion. I'm going to be here for a while yet. Anybody who'd like to talk to me individually, I'm going to be here yet for a while, but I don't think you'd care to maybe stay longer. Thank you.
Chris, that's fine. Thanks for coming. Two announcements. One is I want to invite everybody to the Yom HaAtzmaut program that we'll be having here next week on Wednesday night. We'll be honoring and hearing from three members of the community who fought for the independence of Israel in 1948. And the second announcement, Joseph West.
Called Israel Tomorrow. In 1939, in the area of Poland and Lithuania, my neighbor, when the Germans came, they killed his wife and his child. He ran off to the woods, and he started killing Germans by hand. He and his couple of brothers started doing that. In order to get into his group, he had to kill a German by hand in order to get their guns. They formed the only Jewish group to fight the Germans. There are now 30,000 Jews alive today from that small group.
The Belsky brothers. They are amazing people. The man who led the group, the oldest brother, died a number of years ago. He ended his life basically as a cab driver here in Brooklyn. Nobody recognized the greatness of the man.
It's my neighbor. And his son, by the way, is commando. We have the whole story tomorrow. It's the History Channel. It says Avenue K and Bedford Avenue, Cole Israel. We have a History Channel. In fact, Irish fellow, Peter Duffy, read the obituary in the Times, he did research. And now they have a movie, a major movie with Daniel Craig, the new James Bond. He's starring as Belsky's brother. And Lee Schreiber stars as Belsky, the finest. And that'll be coming out very, very shortly. But it's an amazing, amazing story.
What is the name of the movie?
Defiance. But tomorrow you'll be able to History Channel. Steve Belsky, the son, will tell stories. He was telling a story about at one point 50,000 Germans were overrunning their 1,200 people in the forest. And they know the 50,000 from going back to the German archives. He had arranged for one fighter to be with two civilians. He sees one fighter running without any civilians. He says, where are you going? Where are the girl and woman you're supposed to be protecting? He says, the hell with them. Well, go back and get him. He says, no, every man for himself. Well, Zeus killed the guy right on the spot, and he went back and he got the girl and the woman. While I was airing, Svi says to me, Joe, I was walking my dog past your house on Avenue I, and somebody else, Belsky, it's that girl. She's your neighbor. He said, and the stories like that are just astounding. And Svi himself, by the way, is commando and liberated the Jewish Alliance.
What time is this going tomorrow?
8:30 tomorrow, Avenue K in Bedford at Call Israel. Please come. So, we have C is speaking, we have the panel.